welcome to 15 Minutes in Washington, D.C. I'm Hayley Chatter, Senior Policy Fellow with the Perth US Asia Center. My guest today is Erin Murphy. Erin has had an incredible career, and she's now the Deputy Director and Senior Fellow for the Economics Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. But before that, Erin, you've had what anyone would describe as a very exciting and diverse career. I believe you started off as an analyst with the CIA and you were posted to Myanmar. You've also opened your own boutique consultancy firm on Myanmar. You've had time looking at Japan for the Council on Foreign Relations. And you've also worked for this new agency the US has set up, the US International Development Finance Corporation. So thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to us.
Of course. And thank you for having me.
So, Erin, I think the first one question I wanted to ask was really looking back at the role that you've just come out of from the Development Finance Corporation. As an agency, it's relatively new, but people might not really know much about it or what its purpose is. I mean, it's got development and finance in the title, so people probably understand that it has something to do with development initiatives in countries in the region, as well as working with the private sector. Can you just give a little overview about what the DFC is and how successful it's been so far in a sort of, well, I suppose, 2 years of operations?
2 to 3 years of operations. The DFC is America's Development Bank, and it is the combination of what was known as the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which provided debt financing to firms, primarily U.S. firms working overseas, and political risk insurance. Along with OPIC, it has now taken USAID's Development Credit Authority. So that gives it more of an opportunity to work in emerging markets. So this was a creation of Congress's Build Act. And the idea was for it to compete more in emerging markets and strategic emerging markets as well, but especially in economies on low or lower middle income, as the World Bank defined it. The DFC was also given new tools, including equity finance opportunities, but also the ability to provide technical assistance and feasibility studies. The difference for the DFC to do that is that it would look at a project that perhaps wasn't, you know, ready for the DFC pipeline to be evaluated, but just needed a little oomph to get over the finish line. So the technical assistance and feasibility studies tools were meant to get it ready for DFC pipeline so it could more easily get through it. It was officially set up in about December 2019. And it's, you know, I'm a little biased because obviously I came from there and I was the director for Indo-Pacific. So a lot of my focus was in that region. And we saw a lot of growth. OPIC wasn't as invested in the region, primarily because there weren't a lot of US investors. So one of the critical changes from OPIC to DFC was that the U.S. Development Finance Corporation didn't have to have a U.S. nexus anymore. It could invest in local companies or it could invest with a foreign company looking to get into, say, Indonesia or Vietnam. India is one of DFC's largest portfolios. There's a lot of investments in healthcare, which was once a small investment for OPIC. But for the DFC has really exploded in both importance and in money. So COVID-19, I think that's one area that the DFC has been very successful in terms of increasing the manufacturing of COVID-19 vaccines, but also in helping the healthcare supply chain and working with hospitals to expand its training for nurses and doctors, but also building hospitals with capabilities to work in these areas. Mm.
It really does sound like quite an expansive remit. And from what I've heard, it's sort of a thin on the ground operation in terms of this, you could really do with some more people or resources, for example, considering how extensive its remit is, not just public-private partnerships, but also doing things like health. Mm-hmm. The area I've been looking at here in Washington, D.C., as part of my research, has been infrastructure and how Australia and the United States and some of our allies and partners can cooperate more successfully on delivering infrastructure to developing countries. Hmm. But what do you think about the progress it's made so far on this question of infrastructure in particular? Do you think that it's making real inroads? And what do you see as the main challenges for the DFC going forward?
I think it's making progress. I think if you're looking at it from the outside and you see what the challenges are in the Indo-Pacific, if you're concerned about strategic competition with, say, China, it seems almost too incremental or moving at the pace of a glacier, where from the TFC side, I think things are moving very quickly.
Breakneck speed.
Breakneck. But part of this is the challenge of going from OPIC, that was really kind of a self-starting, self-funding institution that really didn't have a big role in policy. And so there's been a dramatic shift in that, which I think is almost like a whiplash effect for folks that now see itself as a foreign policy tool, but also the answer almost to everything. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to be the answer to everything when you have statutes and mandates that you have to follow, and that you only have 400 to 500 people, and not all of those are transaction officers or policy people. So it is really thin. For Indo-Pacific, I think we saw ourselves as a little more ready to work. We had folks in the field, Mumbai, Singapore, Bangkok, and Jakarta. But infrastructure projects take time, and I don't think there's an appreciation for that. You can't go from concept to contract to shovel ready in just a few months. I mean, think of a home renovation project or trying to get a mortgage for a house. And just in your own personal capacity and how long that takes and the due diligence that you have to do, the paperwork that you have to do, take that and multiply it by a million. And that's kind of what we're dealing with here. There are some challenges for the DFC, and in working with partners, we have differing mandates and requirements. For example, the DFC is meant to mobilize private sector capital. So working with state-owned enterprises is really not in its wheelhouse, where, say, the Australians and Japanese can more easily.
There seems to be quite a lot of restrictions on the DFC mm-hmm. and what it can do that are holding it back. But I wonder if those things could be addressed in future, or how quickly that it could adapt to the circumstances to be more competitive.
I think that there are steps that it can take that it already is. I think one thing is that co-financing on a project is really challenging. And I think we need to kind of move beyond that. Because if you're taking on a loan, if you're a client, if you're a government, you don't want to be doing term sheets from 2 to 3 government bureaucratic institutions. That can be really painful. So I think it's kind of streamlining or looking at where these agencies can work along a project life cycle, or where it can amplify its efforts in a sector. I think what, for example, the Quad did last year is a good example of success on COVID-19. So, for example, the Quad announced in March of last year, we're working on a COVID-19 vaccine initiative. The idea here is we're going to increase in manufacturing vaccines, and then we're going to deliver this to the region. So you had the DFC investing in Biological E, which is an Indian company. We provided financing for them to expand the manufacturing capability for Johnson & Johnson vaccines, but also eventually for their own vaccines that they were hoping to get WHO approval or EUL certified emergency use listing. Japan provided a capital injection into Biological E's day-to-day capabilities. And then India helped, or was supposed to help, with the approvals of the vaccines and helping with the export. And then the US and Australia were really going to help with the last mile delivery. And I think that's a good example of what we can do. So if we're looking at a transportation project, where are our strengths and weaknesses? Japan is really used to working on big infrastructure projects. They've done a lot in terms of special economic zones in Myanmar. They've worked in Southeast Asia. They have a very good sense of that. The DFC brings different capabilities. Australia brings different capabilities. So I think looking at where our strengths and weaknesses are, and, you know, they're not all the same, that we should be able to figure out where we can work. But it's easier said than done, for sure.
Oh, exactly. I mean, just trying to coordinate domestically here would be a challenge with a number of different agencies are looking at infrastructure, let alone working with partners like Australia and Japan and India. But I think it is really important that our 4 countries and others that are interested do collaborate on the whole area of infrastructure and standards, because, frankly, it's a priority for each of the countries to do that. And the Indo-Pacific will need so much infrastructure in the coming decades. Erina, another area I wanted to talk to you about is more broadly about US economic policy. And, you know, you're part of the economics program here at CSIS. And a couple of months ago, President Biden announced a new initiative, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, IPEF. Some people have said that IPEF is an answer to the United States not being part of the CPTPP agreement and for the US to look to try and get more involved in economic standards and trade standards in the region. Can you talk a little bit about IPEF, what it is, what it's seeking to achieve, and what your views are on it?
Sure. You know, I think that a lot of the initiatives that the Biden administration has announced is an effort to commit itself to really important issues like infrastructure. So you have the what was known as Build Back Better World, now known as the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, PGII. I might be getting the I's mixed up. That's an effort with the G7 to address what we're talking about in this infrastructure funding gap. IPEF, I think, is a part of that, or at least hopefully is a part of that, but is really Indo-Pacific specific. That is a very hard thing to say.
Well, you did it perfectly. And you also got the PGII correct, which
excellent.
A friend of mine is calling piggy.
That is unfortunate. Washington is
it rolls
not,
off the tongue.
Oh, definitely. Washington is not, is very talented at coming up with acronyms, but doesn't always think about how it's going to be pronounced later. IPEF is a little less animal friendly, but IPEF really is, I think, you know, an effort to answer the calls that we've heard over and over from the region that the U.S. is not engaged economically here. Especially when we pull back from TPP, which I'm still mourning the loss of. It's different. It's meant to address a lot of the key concerns, especially around how we finance infrastructure specifically for this area, address supply chain issues, which became pretty prevalent during COVID and the war in Ukraine. So that, I think, is something to watch. And I think it's going to be the most successful or at least the most critical out of it. We're already talking about early warning systems, how are we going to friendshore, nearshore, and address these critical food security issues, critical mineral issues, and also, you know, just how we're going to survive COVID and this Ukraine issue. There's also a pillar that's focused on decarbonization and infrastructure. Climate change is on everyone's minds. It forest fires everywhere.
Floods
everywhere. It's just, okay, we have too much water. If only we could give this to the West Coast, that would be fantastic. Looking at the shocking temperatures in Europe. And then, of course, Australia, you know, you're in more of your quiet time now, forest fires, but that's coming.
Yeah, summer is coming.
Yeah, very opposite Game of Thrones. Winter is coming. Yeah. Summer is a lot more of a concern now.
It's very true.
But, you know, these are all critical issues. So how are we going to work together on decarbonization and trying to have infrastructure that, you know, not just doing ports and bridges and airports, but how can we make this so it's resilient to the effects of climate change? So we're not, I mean, look at the roads that are buckling and the bridges or airport runways that are melting in the UK. I mean, these are not going to be issues that are very location specific. This will be global. And I think this is what IPEF is trying to do. There's also a labor and corruption component to this and a trade part of this as well, which is this is, I think, a little confusing to folks because how can you have a trade component with no market access, which was a key part of TPP, you know, in any sort of trade agreement. So that, I think, is going to be interesting. And how do you incentivize us to work all together? IPEF is still very much in early days. I think a lot remains to be seen. We've had a few ministerials. Any negotiation over an economic framework is always
fraught, I would say.
Is the best word. I was trying to think, I'm like, what is the word I'm looking for? You know, it's, you're looking to protect your own economy, but realize you're still part of the global system. And there are a lot of questions that came out of COVID, I think, is, are we still into globalization? Not just COVID, but also the Trump administration, a lot of anti-trade administrations that we saw globally. So I think IPEF is the natural progression of where are we? What do we think about trade? How are we going to go forward? So I hope it's a step in the right direction. I think there's a lot of questions. I think the countries that signed on to the framework basically signaled to the U.S., okay, we're on board, but you have to, you basically have to show us why this is
valuable. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I kind of see it similar to Obama getting the Nobel Peace Prize before he really did anything. It was a signal of trust and confidence saying, okay, now you have to deliver. Mm. So there's a lot in the U.S. to do that.
Well, I mean, last time I was here in Washington, D.C., I was asking U.S. contacts, not what the U.S. could do for allies, but what allies could do for the U.S. And the main thing that I was told back in 2014 was allies could sign up to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm. So it's sort of no wonder that there's a bit of hesitancy or, I guess, question marks around what IPEF is and is it going to stand the test of time. But there's also no doubt that allies in the Indo-Pacific are very eager for the US to stay engaged and to have the US as part of a major trade deal. Erin, just thinking more about your areas of expertise and to sort of round off this economics discussion, I wanted to finally turn the conversation to sanctions because I mentioned before you have a strong background in Myanmar and obviously you saw firsthand some of the impacts of sanctions on that country. Now we have Russia's war in Ukraine and countries are applying sanctions to Russia. Russia in turn is turning off electricity supply to countries and, you know, landmarks in Berlin are falling dark so that Germany can conserve its energy. But I wanted to find out, do you have a view on sanctions on Russia? Are they being effective? Could they be tweaked in any way that would make them more effective? Or, you know, what do you think about sanctions on Russia?
You know, I look at a lot of sanctions programs through the lens of Myanmar because I think there's a lot of magical thinking around sanctions and how effective it can be. But for a country like Myanmar, and even I'd say North Korea to a certain degree, you have to think about how sanctions can be used and how it can be effective. Also, it's an economic tool. So basically, the most effective it can be is, or how effective it can be, is how integrated is that country in the international financial system. Myanmar, not so much. Russia, definitely. So there are a lot of pain points that the United States and its partners can hit on Russia. Even if it was a unilateral sanctions for the United States, I think there are a lot of pain points the United States can hit, cutting it off from the dollar, taking, you know, away its access to SWIFT, which is how banks talk to each other and you can move money from bank to bank. Cutting that off is a very significant pain point. It is even so for Myanmar. But sanctions are also quite effective when you have partners that are able to join you and really kind of turn the screws on a country. So to have Europe on board with that, I think, is very important. I think there were a lot of questions as to how on board is Germany going to be, especially when you have Nord Stream 2, which seemed to only be, you know, the cause of Ted Cruz here in the United States. But then suddenly he, you know, for Ted Cruz, finally had partners on that saying, yeah, okay, we got to turn off the gas on here. But it is much easier now when it is summer to have people on board. But once winter comes, how many people are going to want to take a cold shower? So, you know, we have to think about how long these sanctions can go on and how tight you can squeeze and what the most opportune time frame is to do that. So sanctions is tricky. It's easy to pile on. It's harder to turn off, but then it's harder to also kind of
tweak in the middle to make it more effective. Erin, thank you so much for this because I think the reason our discussion has been so wide ranging reflects your deep and wide expertise in this area. So thank you so much for that.
Of course, and thank you for having me.